Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Philippa Hitchin interviews the Archbishop of Westminster, Vincent Nichols, one of the 19 men to get the red hat at Saturday's consistory here in the Vatican. A linguistic explanation as to why the Pope creates cardinals. Jesuit Father Gerald Fogarty affords us an historical perspective on the reception of Vatican II in the United States. Monsignor Philip Whitmore brings us a musical meditation focusing on Father Faber. But first, Chris Wells reports on the weekly general audience of Pope Francis with pilgrims from across the world.
When I go to confession, Pope Francis said, it is to be healed, to heal the soul, to heal the heart, because of something I've done that's not going right. The sacrament of reconciliation, the Pope said, flows directly from the Paschal mystery. He spoke about Jesus' gift of the Holy Spirit to the apostles when he appeared to them on the evening of the first Easter. Jesus said, receive the Holy Spirit. Whose sins you forgive are forgiven them, and whose sins you retain are retained. This passage, Pope Francis explained, reveals the deeper dynamics contained in the sacrament. First, he said, it shows that we cannot forgive ourselves. Forgiveness must be requested. It is a gift, the gift of the Holy Spirit, who fills us with the washing of mercy and grace that flows from the open heart of the crucified and risen Christ. Secondly, it reminds us that we can only truly be at peace if we are reconciled with the Father and with our brothers in and through Jesus. The Church is the place in which the Spirit is made present, the Pope said, the Spirit who renews our hearts in the love of God and makes us all brothers in one in Jesus Christ. The Pope then asked the crowd when they had last been to confession. Don't say it in a loud voice, he said, but tell me, when was the last time you went to confession?
Quando è stata la ultima volta che ti sei confessato?
2 days? 2 weeks? 2 years? 20 years? 40 years? If a lot of time has passed, don't lose a single day. Be courageous, the Pope said, and go to confession. Pope Francis concluded his audience saying, dear friends, celebrating the sacrament of reconciliation means being wrapped in a warm embrace. It is the embrace of the infinite mercy of the Father. I'm Christopher Wells.
And our thanks there go to Chris Wells. This week was a busy one in terms of meetings for Pope Francis, beginning with his third encounter with the Council of Eight Cardinals, and then with the two new commissions he set up in 2013 to examine the situation regarding the Vatican Bank and the accounting and administrative workings of the Vatican offices, which deal with these affairs. But the story doesn't end here, as on Thursday and Friday, the full College of Cardinals held preparatory meetings for the forthcoming October Synod focusing on the family. Meetings then leading up to Saturday's consistory on the Feast of the Chair of Peter, when Pope Francis will create 19 new cardinals. Among them, Archbishop Vincent Nichols, who heads the Diocese of Westminster, as well as serve as President of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Philippa Hitchin spoke to him ahead of the consistory, beginning by asking him to share with us his personal reactions to the news.
Well, when I heard the news, obviously, I was quite taken aback, even though there'd been lots of chat and lots of, you know, speculation. To me, it wasn't at all clear, given the number of options that the Holy Father had about who he might appoint in a public consistory. You know, my name was there, and I think I'm just beginning to get used to the idea now, but I was a bit taken aback at first.
Pope Francis sent you all a letter, didn't he, reminding people that it's not a promotion or an honour. Were you a little surprised that he would need to remind you that it's really all about service?
I thought it was done with such gracious terminology that I didn't take it as a reminder at all. I took it as a rather wonderful opening up of what lies before us, and the phrase that sticks in my mind is that this is an invitation to broaden our horizons and enlarge the love in our hearts. And I think that sums it up for me entirely. You know, as the bishop here in Westminster, obviously my first focus is the diocese. As president of the Bishops' Conference, we reach out to many, you know, fellow bishops around the world. So it's not as if we're stuck in a narrow perspective. But then to be invited, as it were, to share the perspective of the Holy Father and to share that care for the universal church, for all the churches, is a great, great privilege. As he said, you know, it's a summons to service, and that's a privilege.
In a practical sense, do you think this gives the Catholic Church in England a stronger voice in the public arena?
The reactions that I've had from people here have been quite astonishing. And I don't just mean from Catholics. Catholics, you would expect to be very, very pleased. But it's a reaction right across society. And the two words that people keep using are, firstly, that they're delighted, and secondly, that they will pray. Now, the chief rabbi in a small gathering made a little speech, and he said, this is good for the cause of faith. This is good for everyone who wants to live their lives consciously in the presence of God. So this strengthens us all, was his view. And I think that's shared. This does help to raise the profile of faith, of the project of religious living in the public sphere, yes.
This past weekend, you were making your voice heard. There were headlines regarding your criticism of the government's austerity programme there in the UK, saying there's no longer any safety net for people on the margins. Do you think your voice is being heard over this critical issue? And could you give us a little bit more background on what your concerns are?
Well, what I was saying was I was trying to give an honest and a clear picture of what I learn and what I hear. What I hear from fellow bishops, what I hear from people working in food banks and with other charities. And we've been trying to make something of a priority of these within the diocese. And the word that was used, and we used it in the statement at the end of our last bishops' conference meeting, was that people were seeing destitution in this country. And as one bishop said, I never thought I would say that. I never thought I would see families who have absolutely nothing. So my point was, we need to look at this reality and face it and not pretend that it isn't there. My point was not a kind of overarching criticism of government policy. In fact, I said in the interview, I didn't believe that these were intended consequences. And obviously you have to acknowledge that the reform of a welfare system, and I agree that it needs reform, is a very complex matter. But what I have to keep on saying, and for me it's a privilege, is to echo the voices that I hear and echo the reality that's on the ground. So since the weekend, I've been inundated with emails and messages, most of which add a particular example or illustrate the problems that people are facing. So, for example, one man wrote in and he said, somebody who fails to apply for 6 jobs every week loses their benefit. Now, you have to apply online for these jobs. So if you don't understand computers, if you have problems with literacy, if you don't have access to a computer, then you're likely to lose your benefit. And they could lose it for up to 6 weeks. And then where do they go? They have no money. And these are the people, these are among the people who turn up at the food banks to find food. And when a priest tells me, you know, a young mother comes in, she's given 3 days' worth of food, and she bursts into tears because she hasn't eaten for 3 days. So that's part of the reality. And I believe in a country as resourceful and as affluent as ours, we should be looking at those detailed cases and making adjustments so that that doesn't happen.
Would you like to see, though, more consultation with the church or churches with the expertise that you're gathering in this field?
Well, I would hope, and I believe that there are people who work with government who would be open to these things. And I think what we have to do, and I've asked our Caritas leadership to begin, is to draw some of this information together in a more systematic way so that we can chase through what are the causes of this destitution and hunger.
And Philippa Hitchin there was speaking to one of the 19 new cardinals, Vincent Nichols, who heads the Diocese of Westminster, as well as serve as president of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. For the record, among other cardinals, to name but a few, are the Secretary of State, Archbishop Pietro Parolin, Blessed John XXIII's secretary, Archbishop Loris Capovilla, who at 98 will become the oldest member of the College of Cardinals, the Metropolitan Archbishop of Quebec in Canada, Gerald Cyprien Lacroix, and the Metropolitan Archbishop of Cotabato in the Philippines, Orlando Quevedo. We'll be hearing from them too in the weeks to come on this programme. And now on a more quirky note, why not discover something about the linguistic know-how regarding consistories and cardinals? That's with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster.
And today I'd like to concoct a story, Father. It's a solemn story. And it's about consistories. Consistory, that's a word of Latin origin, isn't it?
Yeah, consistorium, to sit together. Assembly of people sitting together. Well, applied this when the cardinals and the pope were together, was a seating together, consistory. Consistorium.
Well, anyway, we said it's an assembly of cardinals. Cardinal, that's the word that comes from Latin.
Cardo, meaning a hinge on your door. And so cardinalis were the hinges of anything. And so you'd say the hinges of the church are supposed to be the cardinal. So, comes from.
So they're the ones that are summoned at the discretion of the Pope.
Yes, because right? They're supposed to be the important people. The hinges on which the church revolves.
Pope reads their names ahead of the consistory, right? The consistory itself can be secret, semi-public, or public. Those words are all vaguely derived from the Latin, aren't they? Secret?
Well, secretum, when no one else is there and no one knows what's going on. Secret consistories practically don't exist anymore. And then you have public consistories, namely where the doors are kind of open and what's going on in the hall is more or less well-known knowledge.
But public is comes from the Latin.
Yeah, publicus, which belongs to the people.
We speak of the creation of cardinals.
It's correct. Creare means to appoint someone. We think of creation as like, you know, Genesis or God creating the world. But in the dictionary, creare meant to appoint an official, to create someone a senator. That was the idea. And so to create cardinals is to appoint them, period. And that's very classical Latin, really it is. As I say, far away from what we think of creation.
And when they're created, cardinals, the Pope gives them a red hat. How would you say the Pope gives them a red hat in Latin?
Well, dat eis pilium rubrum.
Rubrum meaning
red, and pilium is the little cap. Pileum rubrum is the technical term, the red hat.
And you were listening there to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who was for many years and under many popes, papal Latinist, is currently teaching Latin in the United States. Meanwhile, what I'd like to do now is shine the spotlight on the Catholic Church and the United States at the time of the Second Vatican Council. To do this, I'll be bringing you an interview focusing around the question, how did the Catholic Church in the United States react to the Second Vatican Ecumenical Council? How did it receive the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy? And again, how were the popes of this council, Blessed John XXIII and Pope Paul VI, perceived by the American Catholic faithful of the time? My interviewee on this occasion is well-known author, church historian, Jesuit Professor Gerald Fogarty. Was the American church viewed as progressive in those days?
It was viewed as progressive, but behind the scenes was this developing resistance. It began with the liturgy. It carries through on social teaching, resistance that had already begun by 1961 with Mater Magistra, where there was a group of conservative Catholics that said Mater si, Magistra no.
Then, so in other words, Mother yes, but teaching no.
But teacher,
it was John XXIII's.
That's right. It was his encyclical, which was the 70th anniversary of Rerum Novarum, the first papal
social encyclical by Leo XIII.
What was interesting, by the way, there's been a long dissertation done in Germany recently on the American influence on causing the Pope to issue that first encyclical in 1891, because the American church was mainly of the working class. So therefore they formed labor unions, so therefore the American church supported labor unions and supported the right to strike and things like that. By 1961, many American Catholics were now middle class, so they couldn't see the point of this. And it's gotten worse, and that's come to the present, where now you have many, many, many Catholics who argue the church should not be involved in the social order at all. But, yeah, initially probably the American church was looked at as being progressive, but behind it was still not much of a development of theology. There was development. When I say development, I'm talking about people becoming outstanding theologians and really being concerned about it. And in my opinion, that stopped now. You know, there's no one field that stands out as would have been true 25 years ago.
The council was called for by John the 23rd and Paul the 6th inherited it. What was the perception of the Catholic Church United States of these two popes?
Well, I remember I was a young Jesuit student at the time. I was doing a PhD in history, and a lot of people were concerned that this looked like a reversion back to Pius XII, but people, of course, didn't know anything about Pius XII other than he appeared to be austere and so forth.
So and Paul VI was...
It was a throwback to Pius XII, in which in many ways you would expect him to be because he worked on Rheims for so long. And I was at a dinner party one night, and George Lindbeck, who was one of the Lutheran observers to the Second Vatican Council, just stopped everybody dead by saying, "I suspect I'm the only person here who ever saw Paul VI in person." He said, "I accompanied a group of French students. I was in studies in Paris, and I accompanied this group to Rome, where they had an audience with the Pope, one of those general audiences, you know, something in St. Peter's." He says, "I saw the Pope being carried in the Sedia Justitoria." He said, "I saw the leader of Christendom." That sort of shut us up, where everybody who was criticizing Paul VI. And one argument I would make is I think Paul VI probably was responsible for bringing the council through. And there's more continuity than discontinuity, but this is where many people would disagree with me. And it's partly because I tend to see this as a historian, that each pope is going to put his own mark on something. But nevertheless, I see more continuity in general, because you're not going to reverse something the previous pope did. The other thing is, if you go back to the 50s or 40s, Roncalli would report to the pope pretty much through Montini. So it was a reversal of roles that took place. When Montini was made the Archbishop of Milan, he was not consecrated by the pope. And when he left the Vatican, some suspicion of disgrace, but the other thing was maybe the Pope wanted to get him someplace where he could get out from this tension. So the very first cardinal whom John the 23rd named was Montini. So that's why I say I see more continuity, because he was a curialist. He knew how the machinery worked. I know a lot of other people disagree with me, but I think it probably would have never ended the way it did positively had it not been for the leadership of Montini.
They almost completed each other because...
Yeah, they were complementary. I see them as complementary.
Of course, John the 23rd was a historian, wasn't he?
Well, he started out teaching church history, and he did do a biography of Baronius, but he was also, if you read some of it, he was rather conservative in terms of scientific history.
He was the one who had this idea of improvisatio, no?
Which is something I would say is... a certain spontaneity, which I think is true of the American church. But too many times now, I'm finding any spontaneity, people are going to watch. Like I had all the Eucharistic prayers memorized. And every now and then I'll slip and people will tell me, "You used the older form of this prayer today." Well, at least they were paying attention. But still, the superficial is what grabs them. And any spontaneity is now sort of almost heretical.
So basically, both popes were understood in the United States.
I would say there was a great affection for John the 23rd, but what no Americans realized, it was under John the 23rd the biblical scholars were put under suspicion. So under John the 23rd, the two professors at the Biblical Institute were forbidden from teaching seminarians.
On what grounds?
Complaints about their orthodoxy and so forth, like... Maximilian Zervic was accused of denying that maybe there were three wise men. He was trying to put it in terms of the genre at the time, you know, the literary genre, all this type of thing. They were being accused of heresy.
And, interpretation.
Yeah, and John the 23rd finally forbade them to teach.
Something perhaps Paul the 6th wouldn't have done.
Yeah, Paul the 6th actually restored them. It's a complicated issue, and yet the popular image, John the 23rd, was grandfather figure. The picture of him when he was first elected, he smoked a cigarette once with when he was nuncio to Paris. He had a cocktail glass in his hand, a human side. But these are all on the superficial level. But underneath it, I'd say theologically, probably more was accomplished under Paul the VI. You could debate this because John the 23rd died early. He was an older man. One of the things he did do that most people didn't know, including our CIA, he intervened in the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was obvious. But when he died, the Soviet Navy in Genoa Harbor flew their flags at half-mast. Somebody tried to argue with me. Well, after all, he was the head of state, as it was. The United States didn't fly any flags in Naples at half-mast. The British Navy did. I suspect the British commander could do it on his own, but certainly the Soviet commander could not. Orders came from the Kremlin. And it had to do with this loosening the Ostpolitik that John XXIII started, which gradually was picked up, certainly by Paul VI, and then, of course, really capitalized on by Wojtyla, John Paul II.
So basically what happened at the council is that the council fathers all had a theologian who advised them, no?
Yeah, and then there were special theologians appointed by the Pope as theologians of the council. But after the first session, they seemed to all blend together. Certain theologians appointed by bishops to advise them also ended up as being very prominent. One example I can think of was in regard to the liturgy. The Benedictine Gottfried Dieckmann was a theologian of Cardinal Cicognani, who was then Secretary of State. He had been the American Apostolic Delegate. And Dieckmann was his personal theologian, but then he emerged as an important figure in drafting the Declaration, the Constitution on the liturgy.
Was there a contradiction between the actual event and the documents that eventually came out of the council?
It would depend. The first document that was promulgated was the liturgy. And that's why I said that was the first thing the Americans were aware of. And it came as a shock to many because, as I said, they make the immediate past normative for all the past.
Mm. They approved it in the second session, no?
Yeah. And most American bishops and priests did not know that the first bishop in the United States who proposed the vernacular liturgy was the first bishop, John Carroll. He spoke about it just before he was named the bishop. For him, this was absolutely essential because, after all, the liturgy should be pastoral and should be instructive. So this was shocking to many people when this was brought up. They had been taught this would never change. And, of course, it did change.
You were listening there to church historian and well-known author, Jesuit Professor Gerald Fogarty. Our thanks go to him. Finally, musical notes to end this programme, which coincides with the Feast of the Chair of Peter. For this, we join Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Just over the road from where I live in Rome is the church of San Girolamo della Carità. It's where the much-loved Apostle of Rome, St. Philip Neri, used to live, and it's where he would often hold meetings for prayer and spiritual exercises. These proved very popular with the local people, and in order to accommodate them, an oratorio, or prayer hall, was built above the nave of the church. Music played a large part at these gatherings because St. Philip recognized the power of music to draw with a sweet deception sinners to the holy exercises of the oratory. The congregation of the oratory, now spread all over the world, owes its origin and its name to St. Philip's devotions in the oratorio of San Girolamo. And so too does the musical genre of the oratorio, a form of sacred music usually based on stories from the Bible. It's not surprising, then, after such musical beginnings, that the fathers of the oratory should have produced a great many hymn writers. The first oratory in England was established in Birmingham in 1848 by John Henry Newman. From his pen came such classics as Praise to the Holiest in the Height and Firmly I Believe and Truly. One of the fathers of the Birmingham Oratory, Edward Caswell, specialised in translating ancient Latin hymns into English. And so he gave us Hark, a Herald Voice is Sounding, and Bethlehem of Noblest Cities. But the most prolific of them all must surely have been Father Frederick William Faber, who in 1849 founded the London Oratory, dedicated to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. Thank you. in Father Faber's day, the Catholic community in England was still finding its feet after centuries of exclusion from public life. Not until 1829 were Catholics finally granted permission to worship in public places. And for the first 100 years or so after the Reformation, the persecution of Catholics was severe. Father Faber captures something of the spirit of the English martyrs in characteristically colourful language as he speaks of the faith that lives on in spite of dungeon, fire and sword. That the years of exclusion were over, it was a time of growth for the Catholic Church in England. New schools were built and new churches. New religious houses were opened and new dioceses were established. And as you can imagine, new hymns were composed for all these people to sing. Father Faber's devotional writings were widely read and his hymns were ideally suited for use in popular devotions to Our Lady and to the Blessed Sacrament. That wondrous gift, so far surpassing hope or thought. Surely have warmed St. Philip's heart to see music being used to express such fervent devotion to the Lord Jesus. In the last verse of this hymn, Father Faber calls on the angels to add their voices to the loving praises sung by the faithful. And in the refrain after each verse, he expresses a sentiment that St. Philip Neri would surely have shared wholeheartedly. Sweet sacrament, we thee adore. O make us love thee more and more.
Thanks there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who is currently rector of the Venerable English College here in Rome. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Laudetur Jesus Christus.